This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. We're recording from Freedom Fest in Las Vegas at the Paris Hotel. It's the world's largest annual gathering of libertarians, about 2,000 strong, and I am sitting down with my editor-at-large colleague, Matt Welch of Reason. Hi, Matt.
Howdy, howdy.
And we are talking with former Governor Bill Weld. Bill, thanks for being
Nick,
on
Nick,
the Reason
Nick, always a pleasure. Matt, likewise.
All right, Matt, Matt has a burning question that's burning him almost as much as the sensation he feels when he urinates. Go ahead, Matt. Lay it on him.
Thank you. No, I don't have a burning question, but no, we were just both of us were at the Libertarian National Convention. You participated. God bless you in all the parliamentary shenanigans and votes and everything. As someone who not everyone expected would stay in the Libertarian Party after the 2016 election, which you ran as vice president, describe a little bit your experience at the convention and where you think the party is headed. Is it in a healthy direction? Was the business at the convention in pointing things in the right direction?
Yeah, I think it's in a very healthy direction. And if you recall, back at the 2016 convention, they said, how do you feel after I became a libertarian candidate? And I said, free, free at last, because I've been, you know, running for office for 20 years, carrying around the Republican Party's social policies like a, you know, 30-pound weight on my back. And that's how I did feel. And I have stayed with the party. I've, as you know, self-identified as a libertarian since law school. Friedrich Hayek, Bob Nozick. Presented myself as that throughout my two terms as governor. So it wasn't a big intellectual shift for me. But spending more and more time with libertarians has, I think it's fair to say, immersed me more in the party and where all the thinking is coming from. I spent a long time with David Bowes back a couple of years ago. You know, I've memorized his book, The Libertarian Mind. And so I think... I think if we just set out, we the Libertarian Party, set out our view as to what needs to be done for the country, it will be impossible for anyone to label libertarians as a fringe party. Hmm. Because what has to be done is quite obvious. And we'll get into that, I hope.
So, yeah, well, let's get into the specifics in a second. But before we do that, you guys were both at the convention. And let me ask you, because on a certain level, Governor, you are the pragmatic. You represent pragmatic libertarianism where you may or may not be subscribed to a super, Robert Nozick would call a night watchman state. But whether you do or not, you're interested in going from where we are now to a little bit closer to freedom and deregulation and just letting people live their lives, right?
Well, I'd go as quickly as we can,
yeah,
within reason.
But, you know, then there are the people in the Libertarian Party that are like, no, what we need to, we're not about electing people to office, much less, you know, running credible campaigns. It's much more about a kind of philosophical commitment to really anarchy, not even libertarianism or limited government.
So, or as an education project,
yeah,
to try to, instead of chasing after 70 million votes, you chase after changing 1 million people's minds forever.
So I guess, let me ask you, Governor, how do you do that? Because you want to influence the major, you know, the Republican and Democratic Party, you want 70 million votes. What is your message to fellow LP members who are like, no, you know what we really need to do is to hold the line on, you know, public sidewalks? We've got to be against public sidewalks, and that's got to be our main,
yeah,
you know.
If anybody's interested, I think it's fair to say that the alignment of the stars in Washington these days with the huge standoff between the Republican and Democratic parties, and both of them being either extreme right or extreme left for various reasons, that makes it more likely than it's ever been that a third party, it could be the Libertarians, could be somebody else, will win the presidential election in 2020. And, you know, it's been pointed out that the odds of a third party winning in 2020 are probably greater than the odds of Donald Trump winning the presidency 2 years before he did. Or the odds.
Did you just, you say it's been pointed out. You just pointed that out.
No,
and it's
no.
Pretty good, but
no,
I don't do that.
The original was a consultant named Juliana Glover who wrote an article in the Times Sunday magazine. Very good article.
Yeah.
And you could say the same about Emmanuel Macron in France. His party didn't exist 2 years before he was elected president.
And there's a good chance it's not going to exist in 2 years from now, right? But No, that is kind of awesome. Matt, are you, what you tell us in front of Governor Bildwell, you know, are the purists, for lack of a better term, in the LP, are they going to get behind if in fact Bill Weld runs for the candidacy, you know, for the nomination for presidency? Are they going to be like, yeah, let's go with this guy? Are they going to be, no, we got to go join the Ludwig von Mises Super Murray Rothbard secret society, where we have no influence, but we are absolutely pure on all the big issues?
I think, and Governor will correct me where I'm misconstruing this, as people in the Libertarian Party tend to do whenever I talk about LP politics, but the major contests at the convention in which delegates were offered the opportunity to express their opinion about that strategy, big tent versus sort of small tent education project, the big tent won. And in pretty much every case, is that your impression of the
proceedings?
Well,
certainly
there?
Nick Czarwark, 3-1. That was a clarion bell in the night. As you got down to some of the lower offices, I don't think it was unanimously
right.
the case.
But
I'm pretty sure the Libertarian Party is the only place. You know, the idea about you want to be, you want to be in the tent pissing out, but it's like the Libertarian Party is the only place where the small tent group wants to be in the party, wants to be in the tent pissing on each other, and the big tent wants to be pissing out. I don't know. It just,
well, tell
it's
us
a fetching metaphor.
Yeah,
Nick.
I apologize for the earlier. Urological focus, but
one of the charming things to observe at these conventions, because they're small affairs, that's one hall and like a couple adjacent places, so you're going to run into everybody who you've been slagging on Facebook and YouTube. And so the governor's not a short man, and he's walking around with all these people who don't like him. And it's not, I'm not saying it's the majority of the room, right. But there are people who at various times during convention business were like, Bill Weld, what about that? But they come up and talk to him. So what were those interactions like?
They were all good. Nobody spat in my face. There was a certain amount.
And finish that thought. Did you spit in anyone's face?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
I think for some people, it's going to take a lot of getting used to the idea of a Bill Weld candidacy for president if it happens in the Libertarian Party. I will say I went over.
Can we lose the if? What's it going to take for you not to run for president?
There's just too many unknowns between here and there. Anybody can have a health event. It's too far away.
Okay.
But I'm very enthusiastic about the party. Let me put it that way. But, and here's an interesting tidbit for you. I walked over to the Radical Caucus booth and talked with a guy from Michigan who's manning the booth. I bought two mugs and all of their literature. And on the plane going back from New Orleans to Boston, I read the literature, and it included a very thoughtful piece by a guy called Clayton Hunt, who's one of the two actors outer on stage, both in NOLA and the other one being James Weeks in NOLA and in Orlando. And I note that James Weeks got 80 votes for something. It was either vice chair or at-large delegate. That's not nothing.
Yeah.
So these guys are not unknown in the party, and they have friends. And I thought Clayton Hunt's piece was very good. It read like more of a middle-of-the-road analysis than a Screaming Mimi analysis. So it may be that the delta there is not quite as large as people perceive when they judge only by the timbre of the rhetoric.
Talk a little bit about how, and you and I have discussed this before, but how exposure to these crazy libertarians have changed you or opened your eyes in a different direction or moved you off a position that you've had before.
And I'm sorry to jump in. Define for people what you mean by crazy, because when you say crazy libertarians, you are not, I mean, you're not saying,
I'm saying
not
every,
a pejorative I'm, term.
It's an that affectionately is, pejorative term.
Okay. And well, it is pejorative. There
no,
is
no,
some
it's not.
Perjuration.
It's not. I mean, I use that to describe myself when I'm talking about small L libertarians.
Yeah.
Libertarians are, it is a marginal party at this point, although it's the largest third party by far in every single state. You will be exposed. I mean, Adam Kokesh has a booth right around the corner. He's running for president in 2020, and his plank is to dissolve the federal government. That's not a middle of the road kind of 1990s governor approach. But so
I don't think libertarians are crazy at all. Every libertarian believes that a government should be a lot smaller and less intrusive. Adam wants to go all the way and dissolve it on day one. But in order to make it, and this I know what I'm talking about for once, In order to make the government smaller, you got to do a couple of things. The first thing you got to do is cut spending. And the only way to cut spending, I'm certain, is to cut spending, i.e. it takes political will. There's no magic formula. And we did that in the 90s in Massachusetts, a state that was called Taxachusetts until I got there, no more. Cut it in real dollars from year to year. And I was voted by Cato and the Wall Street Journal the most fiscally conservative governor in the United States. And that's in Massachusetts. That's what has to happen. You got to cut absolute dollars year over year at the federal level. We need, obviously, a balanced budget amendment. The next thing we have to do is cut taxes rather a lot. Again, I've had some experience there. Cut taxes 21 times, never raised them, and the economy roared off. The unemployment rate went from worst to best of the industrialized states in 3 years. So that's the main thing. But
can I ask before you go? Okay, so you have
so those
just
are economic issues.
Yeah, you have, well, which are important, and let's talk about it because I mean you hit the trifecta there, right? You want to cut spending, you want to cut taxes, and you want to balance the budget. But what kinds of spending comes first? Because there's a broad constituency among Republicans and even some Democrats. They'll be like, yeah, I want to cut spending. I want to cut defense spending. Republicans will say, you know, I want to cut all that free welfare money that trans people using bathrooms and Target, you know, of their gender of choice, not of birth, are using. Like, you know, it's destroying us. It's holding us back. So what kind of spending?
I think
specific.
The only way to do it is to zero base the budget from year to year. So you start analyzing every account, assuming that the account is zero. Not that it's the same as last year plus 5%. In Washington, they say anything less than last year plus 5% is a cut. It's so crazy. And in Massachusetts, we actually increased some accounts in the healthcare area where there have been very good outputs and efficiencies in the previous year, a lot of good health outcomes. But it is simply amazing until you get under the hood how many government programs don't have any outputs. They just have inputs, i.e. last year's spending.
So
you can
name
cut
one.
Big
what,
things.
And not necessarily, this isn't the old kind of Republican Party nomination, you know, presidential debate thing where it's like, name three programs that you would zero out. And, you know, most former governors of the Republican Party apparently can't count to three. They can only get to two. And then they're like, oh, man.
That's
you know,
unkind.
This is math. No, but I'm joking because actually Rick Perry, as far as governors go, is like, you know, he was better than worse for sure. But so what are things that have to be cut? Zero-based budgeting sounds great. And I can, you know, you can already hear people in Congress having heart attacks or, you know, if they're even sentient. But where do we cut?
So we cut a lot in social services spending, probably in the first year, $300 million off a budget of $14 billion. And the way we did that is by transferring the service delivery systems from the government to the private sector. And there are all kinds of nonprofits who want to deliver services to the mentally ill, the developmentally disabled, the down on their luck. Their people, so to speak.
They've been trying to get in
to deliver that and be paid for it for decades.
And the liberals would
never let them in. They say, no, the state has to do that. That's the nanny state.
Is that through a voucher? Like, who gets the money? Is it the
patient? The 501c3s get the money.
Okay. And there isn't a problem there where you start to say, if it's a religious group, you know, the Catholic Church loves to help people.
My best social service agency was the Catholic Church.
But then
there's no question about it.
You can hear the libertarian side, you know, alert, danger. Like, so
no,
you're
going
to be transferring public tax money, which shouldn't exist, to a religious entity.
Absolutely. That's a bridge you've got to cross. And what we did was we closed down all these great big red brick buildings that looked and served like prisons. We knocked them all down and said, okay, we're going to go to halfway houses in the city, in Dorchester and Roxbury and Mattapan for the minority populations, no more than 11 residents to a house, four staff for every 11 residents, huge improvement in the staffing ratio, and so much less intrusive. I mean, there weren't bars on the windows, and it was just so much greater dignity for the recipients of care who were no longer referred to as inmates. They were referred to as customers.
So social service is a big place. What about something like, you know, I mean, the big ticket items are defense spending, Medicare, Medicaid and Social Security?
Well, in Medicaid, I would try to go back to some closer connection between Medicaid spending and healthcare need for it. Right now, Medicaid has grown to where it covers, I'm not a great expert on this, but my impression is it covers a great many more things than it used to. And that's part of the problem in healthcare, which is the government mandating exactly what's going to be done. Instead of letting people have health savings accounts, everyone's got to have a Cadillac. Again, it's the nanny state. It's the Cadillac, and the government is going to pay for it because you're too stupid to make your own decision about healthcare.
And so I just want to point out that
that's
the
big,
government
big
is,
ticket item, by the
is
way.
Still talking about Cadillacs. And it's like,
yeah,
when's
no
the
kidding.
Last time? I mean, Matt, our our parents were even like, you know, we're over Cadillacs. Like, can we talk about Mercedes-Benz healthcare?
My dad finally got rid of his Cadillac. America has turned the
talk
page.
Talk about a dead brand.
You're talking a lot about sort of concrete policy issues here. There's something like 170, I think, elected libertarians across the country in various offices. You've gotten to meet some of them. You've been going around on on the endorsement circuit, endorsing
right.
some of these people. And some of them are engaged in pretty tangible, getting your hands in their reforms. Can you talk about some of the people that you've met and that you're interested in that they've been doing in office?
Well, Laura Epke from Nebraska, who converted from Republican to Libertarian, one of our best speakers. My current thinking is she's so good, I'm going to go out and campaign for her in Nebraska. She's on the ballot for November 6th.
She needs it. She was down by 10 in the first.
No, I know. I know. You know, on our endorsements, there's a guy named Matt Dubin who's running for state assembly in Seattle, Washington, who's just hit the seam perfectly. He's gone into the business community and taken them over on a tax issue where the opposition was getting behind some huge, useless tax increase. Jeff Hewitt in California is poised to take over the Board of County Commissioners in Riverside County. In California, that's real power. If you want something done in Los Angeles, you go to the county officials. You don't go to the mayor. So those are some examples of the, Mark Tibbetts in Texas, candidate for governor. Neil Dykeman, candidate for senator. Those guys, I was at the Texas convention when they were nominated.
So
those guys are top shelf. They could run as an R or a D. They wouldn't say the same things. But in terms of their capability, no one would think twice having them at the top of the ticket.
We've been talking a lot about the dynamic between you and the Libertarian Party. What about, and you said earlier, you know, people are, you know, if they hear libertarian ideas, they're going to be like, oh, yeah, that's who I am. And, you know, why am I clinging to the Republicans and Democrats? What is the message? Is there a specific message to Republicans
yes.
and
well,
to Democrats? And are they different?
There's a message to everybody. And I think it's subtly different than the message that Gary Johnson and I carried last time, which was too close to we're fiscally responsible and socially tolerant. Therefore, you have to vote for us. No, that's not enough analysis for the voters. And it's eerily reminiscent of the R's saying you have to vote for us so we can kill the D's, and the D's saying you have to vote for us so the R's don't win. So I think the message is nobody has to vote for us. And by the same token, nobody has to vote for the R's or the D's. All we want you to do, Mr. and Mrs. Voter, is to listen. And here's what we have to say. And then I talk about everything I was just talking about shrinking the size of government and how it can be done and how it has been done. And get into the entitlements and get into foreign policy. And if people don't agree and don't want to vote for us, that's great. But if they would just apply the same standard to us in terms of listening as they apply to their own party, the R or the D party, I think we'd be fine. Gary Johnson used to say during the 2016 campaign, just put my name in the poll and we'll let everything, my name, Gary Johnson's name, in the poll, and we'll let everything else take care of itself if people are just listening. I think you'd see Libertarian Party at 10-15% almost immediately, and it probably would go, in my estimation, up from there as opposed to down from there.
It's remarkable to go and look at, for example, the Senate races, 33 Senate races, of which maybe 10 are toss-ups at this point, and you go and look at the state polling there, and there are some good Libertarian candidates in some of these things. Toss-up could affect the election. None of them are being polled. There's I think I saw why, what was spelunking through this yesterday, I saw maybe one poll of one Libertarian in one of the toss-up Senate races, and that's it. It's a very, very difficult.
I'm going to be making a lot of noise about that point if this thing proceeds in 2019.
Yeah, where is the resistance to hold, you know, to listing third-party candidates or even a none of the above? I mean, Matt, and I'm asking you this as much as Bill, but is it in the media or is it in the parties or is it that the parties indirectly kind of control the media? Say, like, come on, you know, it's a clown show. Why would you include Bill Weld in a poll? We've got some serious stuff going on here.
Well, the parties control the Federal Commission on Debates, and that's not indirectly, that's directly. Yeah. And both Mike McCurry and Frank Fahrenkamp will tell you on top of the table, no, our business is to make sure that it's R&D party. They're not being meretricious about it at all.
Yeah.
And because they do, of course they're not going to put Gary Johnson's name in a poll. Not when independent polls have Gary polling at 13% nationwide a week before the decision is made on the federal presidential debates. And if he gets to 15, then they're obliged to include him. And Gary was at 39% among millennials that same time frame. So that was just too much for the R party and the D party. And they would do anything to have that have his name not in the polls. And I'm sure they pressured the pollsters not to put it in.
There's a couple of rationales that are given I think you shoot holes straight in. One is that they observe correctly that polling for third parties always exaggerates their ultimate outcome. I mean, there's a couple of exceptions to that, but generally you're going to slice a third off. Gary, you guys were polling at 4.8% on election day and they got 3.3. That's like predictable even. On some level, that's true, but you can bake that into the numbers. It's not up to you to kind of make that decision. The other excuse that you'll hear is, well, we're doing this poll, but we're doing it with our media partners, and our media partners wanted this. And in states like New York, where everyone hates the incumbent governor Cuomo in New York, you've got
none more than people who are directly related to him.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Larry Sharp, who's a really energetic Libertarian candidate. He raised the second most money in the race. He's in there a lot. Cynthia, what's her face? The former
Nixon. Yeah. Good name in politics, right? Talk about a Cadillac brand, Nixon.
She's going to be on the ballot for the Working Families Party, and they're still not even putting her in the poll, let alone Larry Sharp. It's astonishing. They're coming out with polls that are actually inaccurate.
Well, as I say, I'm going to make some noise on that, and I think it's utterly indefensible. For example, just to take a hypo, let's say I do run and I'm at 14% the day before the debate decision is made. It's not like I'm going to get up there and not be able to hold my own in a debate against Donald Trump and a left-wing Democrat. And I think the Dems are going to go left. And if you don't believe me, go look at the 8 debates I had with Senator John Kerry when he and I ran against each other in 1996. That was the marquee race of the season. And people thought the debates were pretty good, pretty high quality. So I wouldn't be trepidatious about getting into those debates. And once you get into the debates, I honestly think if I went into those debates at 15% and could talk about some of the things we've been talking about right here in terms of what needs to be done in Washington, that 15 would go up. It wouldn't go down.
What is the path as you look forward? You've talked a lot about how the Republican parties might go the way of the Whigs. We're just in this weird moment where the Democrats are becoming the party of Bernie Sanders. Republicans are definitely becoming the party of Donald Trump. A lot of issues that are completely antithetical to traditional kind of Republican issues.
And Democratic values, too. I mean, it's funny when you mentioned John Kerry, it's like I'm thinking, okay, wait, is this John Kerry in the 90s where he was a centrist Democrat? I mean, he wasn't the clown who ran against George W. Bush who couldn't beat, you know, I mean, the two great kind of electoral events, Matt, in a lot of ways, I think, in our lives, right, is that John Kerry couldn't beat George W. Bush, who sucked on everything. It was super unpopular. John Kerry couldn't beat him. And then
Hillary
Clinton couldn't beat Donald Trump. I mean, like, what the fuck is wrong with these people? Like, they are so bad. But Kerry, not... Kerry doesn't make sense in today's Democratic Party.
Right.
And that, yeah.
So how does it break up? Who goes where and when? You've obviously visualized this to some degree.
Well, I mean, I think there are outreaches that the Libertarian Party can easily take. Take an issue like cannabis. To have that scheduled as a Class 1 narcotic in Washington is beyond reason. You know who gets that? Millennials get that. Veterans get that. 20 suicides of veterans every day in this country with PTSD because they can't legally get access to that drug. And a third voting block that gets that is the elderly who are using cannabidiol, the benign element.
I mean, you know, to the extent that old people even wake up, they're waking and baking every day.
They're waking
high
what?
Is all,
waking and baking. In pain. Yeah, and cannabidiol, which is an element of cannabis, absolutely is the best palliative known to man and woman. And so those are three big voting blocks.
Wait, so you're doubling down on the idea there are only two genders, Governor? You know, you just
touché,
lost everything.
You got me there.
Well, and in that sense, okay, so Matt is asking, though, are there, like, you have good arguments to say, look, you know, and the pot issue, and it's not even the pot issue, it's pain issue, really. It's like, do you get to control more of your
pain,
medicine?
Nausea, epilepsy,
and
cancer.
Taking the edge off. Yeah, no. I mean, that's great, but those are issues and positions that I agree completely would resonate widely. But are there events like, does Donald Trump have to be revealed to be even more of a liar and a faker than he is? Does
well, not possible.
Bernie Sanders...
That's not possible.
But does Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren has to get the 23andMe test back, and it's like, she actually is 100% Russian and is being controlled by the... Like, what are the events... Or the kind of markers that
I
would allow this conversation to start.
It may be a change in the flavor of the water table, so people decide, well, maybe we will think for ourselves, because maybe we do think that the monopoly in Washington is not serving us well.
Talk about the social issues you had started to talk about, and we tend to think about, you know, our libertarians, I think you're right, and Matt, I think in the Declaration of Independence, I think we were pushing against this, but it's hard to avoid, right? That the Republicans are great on economics, but they suck on social issues. The Democrats are great on social issues, but they don't know anything about economics. And then when you start thinking about it, it's like, actually, the Republican Party is awful, and Trump certainly is on economic issues
social issues. They're bad
issues.
On both now.
Yeah,
and they're bad on free trade. That's not a good start.
No, but what about on the Democrats' side? Because they are terrible on social issues. Like, where are the Democrats who are like, oh, yeah, you know what? Maybe cannabis should be descheduled. Maybe we should be more open.
There's no maybe about it. If I may, I was out there by myself for 10 years, the decade of the 90s, on medicinal marijuana. Came out for that in 1991 for relief of glaucoma and nausea from chemotherapy, because those were known at that time, and came out for gay and lesbian rights in 1991. Appointed the woman who wrote the opinion that went to the Supreme Court, establishing that gay and lesbian marriage is commanded by both
gay
equal protection.
Gay and lesbian marriages can be just as tedious and awful as heterosexual marriages.
Well,
if we can't all be happy together, let us all be sad together.
Well, the pursuit of happiness is guaranteed, or it's mentioned in the Declaration of Independence, and I think rightly so. Sometimes it's life, liberty, and property. Sometimes it's life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And to say, no, you can't live with who you want to, seems to me kind of a major exception from allowing the pursuit of happiness.
What are some signposts this year, 2018, that will be indicators of health for the Libertarian Party? What do you need to see? The National Party has a budget of like $1.5 million. That's nothing. That is what can you do with $1.5 million?
You know, I dropped that last night on video poker here in Las Vegas.
Yeah, sure,
Freedom Fest.
That was just the quarter
annual
machine.
It must be nice to be independently wealthy, I'll tell you.
Yeah, you know, it's well. You know what? What's unlike you, Governor Weld? My family on both my mother's and father's side go back dozens of years in this country. So yeah, I really couldn't explain it to you. You have to experience it.
So what needs to happen? What are some moments, some milestones that need to be hit in 2018 or in the near future, even before 2020, to build the way for something long shot?
Well, obviously there's going to be a taking of stock after the midterms, and as soon as that happens, I think people are going to focus on whether they're satisfied with the duopoly of the R Party and the D Party in Washington, D.C. We're having a rally here on that topic at 6:30 tonight. If everyone says, oh, we love the monopoly, we love having no competition, we're not going to listen, we're just going to cling to mommy and daddy's party, then that bodes ill
you
for the libertarians.
You have an incredible amount of anger towards the voters who spurned you in 2016, don't you? You're calling them children, you're saying they're clinging to mommy and daddy.
No, the people who cling to mommy and daddy's party are the R's and the D's.
Yeah.
The libertarians, we were invented in 1971. Okay. So
it's
not
merely, you're only angry at 97% of the American electorate?
I wouldn't say angry, but I would say that I do have a message there, which is just listen to us.
Yeah.
My wife introduced me at rallies in the 2016 campaign, and she said, I know what you're thinking. It's like a scary movie out there, and you can't change the channel. Well, and this is Trump versus Clinton.
And then she said, but enough about my marriage. Here's Governor Wolf.
No, she said, but you can change the channel. All you have to do is listen and make up your own mind. Here's Billy. Very powerful introduction, I thought. But then I think she's a powerful woman.
So what, did you, I mean, are you trying to get back in her good graces or something? This seems a little bit odd, Governor.
No, I'm in her good graces. She just spent the last week going to guitar camp in the Catskills in New York.
So wow.
She's in a very good mood. I just talked to her.
So she's learning Jewish guitar or something? What is that? At Grossinger's and eating rye bread?
Well, I mean, she had that coming after having to go to a Libertarian Party convention for 4 years.
She did have that coming. It was a big treat.
Matt was asking a serious question. Are there things that have to happen both to like shake up the duopoly a little bit, but then also, I guess, I mean, you're asking also like on a personal level, like what do you need to see? After the midterms, do you think the midterms are going to be, everybody's predicting there's, you know, the midterms will be clarifying. There hasn't been a clarifying event in America since 9/11.
Yeah, I don't think the midterms are critical to the libertarians. Either the Democrats win the House, in which case you'll see an impeachment of President Trump right away. And I'm not sure that's bad for President Trump. It's probably not good for him because it's 12 months of bad publicity. But unless something drastic happens, which I don't foresee, you'll never see 67 votes to convict in the Senate. So it'd be interesting. If the Republicans win, that might be even better for the Libertarian Party because it would preserve the current calcification.
Mm. So do you see...
That's just speculating.
Do you see more... you asked this, Matt. I mean, do you see more Republicans leaving their party and looking elsewhere than Democrats? Or because, I mean, implicit in what you were saying is that the Republican Party is calcified. And so, and there already are a lot of never Trumpers. There are very few public, like never Elizabeth Warren's, never Sanders.
Right, right. Well, I do think, on the other hand, that there is a division between the Democrats who want to go far left and the more establishment Democrats from the past. So Chris Coons, is a U.S. senator from Delaware, said yesterday, we got to stop this lurch to the left. You know why he's saying that? Because he sees what's going to happen electorally.
When they say we got to stop this move to the left, is that on economic issues mostly? Because, you know, it's funny. Bernie Sanders was no friend to identity politics. Remember early on in I think it was in Seattle, where he literally got pushed off the stage by Black Lives Matter people because people were like, Sanders, you're like this, you know, super white guy. And it is kind of great just to pause for a moment and recognize that like a Brooklyn-born Jew, like who was born in the 30s, is now super white. Like, so something has been changing in America.
I thought,
he was like, you don't care about black people. You don't care about lesbians. You don't care about, and he was pushed off
the black
stage.
People, I think that is probably true. I thought a telling moment that happened again and again in the campaign, Trump guys would pick at our rallies and someone would say, do black lives matter? And then the Trump guys would say, all lives matter. Mm. That is nothing but a dog whistle to the black haters and the white supremacists. Nothing but a dog whistle. In fact, the whole campaign was kind of a connected series of dog whistles. So I would take the mic and say, no, the correct answer to that question is yes, black lives do matter. And that would kind of throw a wet blanket on the Trump guys who'd come to harass us. But we can tell that story to the black community. We can tell a story about, reorganizing social services so that it won't be so paternalistic.
Right.
There's a lot that can be said to the
or
black voting bloc.
Penitentiary-like.
Well, the cannabis, you know, a black person who's arrested for possession of marijuana, who's caught with possession of marijuana, is four times as likely to get arrested, four times as likely to go to prison, four times as likely to have a four times as long prison sentence. I mean, social justice is one of the major reasons why I joined the board of this cannabis company in New York back in April. There's a major social justice element. And beyond that, there's a major redo that has to be done with respect to addiction in general. And I don't care whether it's alcohol or whether it's narcotics. And if it's narcotics, I don't care whether it's marijuana or heroin. We got to stop treating addiction in this country as a criminal justice priority and realize, recognize it for the healthcare emergency that it is. National
healthcare emergency. What is your favorite street term for heroin, Governor?
I don't know. I haven't had
Charlie,
the pleasure.
Horse,
no, I
H.
Haven't had the
Skag.
Pleasure.
I remember Skag.
I call it heroin.
About
okay.
2-3 weeks.
I don't want to guess wrong, okay?
Okay. There are no wrong answers.
Safe. About 2-3 weeks before the end of the last campaign election, you issued a kind of specific warning about Donald Trump. You said to Republican voters or people thinking about flirting with the idea.
Not stable enough to be president.
We're giving you the opportunity to take that back right now.
It ruffled some people's feathers. They thought you were pointing one side instead of both
sides.
Well,
and you semi-endorsed Hillary Clinton.
Let's table that.
No, actually, it wasn't where I was going.
So okay. You go there afterwards. Has Trump been as bad as you forecasted? How has he played out in your mind compared to what you were warning about those 2-3 weeks before the election?
Worse.
In what way?
Well, to lie every day to the American people. That is not something that, to say I'd never criticize the Prime Minister of Britain the day after he just raked her over the coals. To say to NATO, we got to go to 4%. And to say the next day, no, I never said that. I didn't say that. Even when the things he said were on the public record, it's like he doesn't care whether what he says is true. And I don't think this is a vicious dig. I think this is right out there on top of the record. People say, well, he's invincibly ignorant. He can't be held to account. I don't buy that for a second. He's teaching lessons to our children, to the next generation. And that should not come out of the Oval Office in the White House.
So address the Hillary Clinton question. A lot of people in libertarian world, small L and capital L, were like, yeah, look, you effectively endorsed Hillary Clinton towards the end of the election.
I went on that TV show, but I picked my word carefully. I did not say endorse. I was feeling kind of sorry for Mrs. Clinton, just as a human being, because everybody in the whole world was saying, lock her up. She's a crook. I've known her for over 30 years. She's not a crook. And
how
doesn't deserve
dare
to be
you
locked up.
On a libertarian podcast say that Hillary Clinton should not be in jail?
Anyway, I've known her for a long time and favorably. So I said, I vouch for her. And I went on to say, it's too bad nobody else will vouch for her other than members of the Democratic National Committee. Because it's quite true. Nobody was vouching for her at all. And everyone was kind of letting Trump run with his lock her up, and nobody called him on it.
But that's also,
but
somewhat, and this is no defense of Trump, but it is telling that you have a quarter of a century in public life like Hillary Clinton, including being a senator from New York, a secretary of state, and she couldn't get anybody to speak out in her favor in a tight presidential race.
It mystified
right?
me as well.
Yeah. Oh, it doesn't mystify me. I think it kind of makes sense, and it helps explain why she lost. Like, she couldn't bring people out. But so you will not, if you run for president as the Libertarian Party candidate, you will not be endorsing or speaking well of, and these are very
vouching,
two different
vouching.
Things, vouching for the Democrat or Republican candidate in
Well, I call him as I see him. Let's say I'm in a debate and I think someone is being unfairly attacked. I would probably say that. I call him as I see him. But, when I hear from my customary well-wishers in the R Party, you can't run because it might help the Dems. Or from the D Party, you can't run or it might help the R's, I'm just going to have three words. Save your breath. Listen to what I said about the duopoly.
I thought you were going to go with something that starts, that it would be abbreviated GFY. But save your breath is pretty good.
Matt,
take us out with the final question that we're going to finally stump Governor Bill Weld.
It's not a stump. It's a point of information, as they say, in the parliamentary procedures. Are you out there trying to peel off the Chris Coonses of the world, or the Jeff Flakes, the Bob Corkers, and saying, hey, look, you're frustrated. There's an actual home for you that shares more of your values than the current Republican Party. Is that an activity that you think you will be engaging in?
Well, I think the thing to do right now is not say, let's go bag the biggest Democrat we can and let's go bag the biggest Republican we can, because until the midterm elections occur, speaking of saving your breath, those would be words for which the breath would be better saved, because no one's going to listen to that right now. There are some people who, it's crossed my mind, might endorse the Libertarian ticket in 2020, depending on how things look in 2019. So, yeah, I'd be there with bells on for that. But that doesn't mean, you know, come join us and be vice president. It just means come join us.
Right.
Wow. That's great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Matt Welch and I, Nick Gillespie, have been talking on The Reason Podcast to former Governor Bill Weld, former governor of Massachusetts. You ended Taxachusetts, didn't you?
I don't think they use the term much anymore.
Okay, or at least, but I mean, it must have also been a great relief. You followed Michael Dukakis, right?
Directly followed him.
Yeah, so that's got to be great. I mean, that's like you take over a team after they've lost 100 games, right? You'll never look that bad in a tank, right?
We don't know. I've avoided tanks since that incident.
I would love a president who avoided tanks. I don't know about Matt, probably. So Matt Welch and Nick Gillespie on The Reason Podcast talking to Governor Bill Weld. Thank you so much, Governor.
Thank you very much. Good to
Please
be here.
Please subscribe to us at iTunes, Google Play Music, Reason.com, wherever you like to get your podcast on, and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks so much for listening.